live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live from our studios in New York. I'd like to welcome everyone. Today, the latest in health and healing. In fact, the entire hour is devoted to how can we live a longer and healthier life. No guests today. Just you having an opportunity to share whatever questions you have from any of the topics we cover, please feel free to do so. I'll be taking calls in about 15 minutes. But first up, I'm sure some of you over the internet have been listening to Mike Adams and others talk about how they're really harassing the raw dairy individuals, the milk dairy, the goat's dairy, and the FDA is behind this. The question is, how bad is raw milk that they should be doing this? Well, this is from the Alliance for Natural Health, and I'll quote what they have to say on this. A report from Harvard suggests that milk from factory farms may be associated with hormone-related cancers because of the industrial agricultural practice of milking a cow throughout her pregnancy. Mind you, we're talking about not organic milk now. We're not talking about free-range cattle, but factory farm cattle. The later in pregnancy a cow is, the more hormones appear in her milk. Milk from a cow in the late stage of pregnancy contains 3,300% as much as a signature estrogen compound, like estrone sulfate, as milk from a cow following pregnancy, as well as much higher levels of other hormones. Now, the very healthiest milk would therefore be raw, grass-fed, organic, and from a cow that is only milked for the first 6 months after giving birth, which would include the first 4 months of a new pregnancy. Why can't we get milk that even remotely resembles this ideal? It's because federal regulatory policy, controlled by special interests like the dairy industry, is making our milk even more and shackling consumer choice. Congress is set to introduce the 2012 Farm Bill, which will set the course of federal agriculture and food assistance programs for the next 5 years. It will have a major impact on farmers, consumers, rural communities, and global agribusiness. Now, current federal regulations are designed to encourage farmers to take dairy cows off pasture and put them into the controlled environment of a factory farm. The regulations called the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance are written for statutory systems to increase milk production per cow. This is known as the total confinement dairy model. That is, the huge dairy factory farms would benefit. This practice, however, cuts the productive life expectancy of a cow in half or even more, creates unmanageable diseases, not to mention an environmental disaster, hurts smaller organic dairy farmers. The real solution is to find the most cost-effective model specific to a region's particular environment and balance that with the health of the cow and the best possible milk product. For example, what works in the arid climates of the western U.S. Will not work in the more humid climate of the southeast. The federal government seems to feel that all milk is the same, whereas the nutrient content, such as batter, fat, and protein, varies greatly between different breeds of cow. According to our source, the 2012 Farm Bill may contain provisions to outlaw component pricing of milk, in which a producer is paid for a more high-protein or higher butterfat milk. Component pricing tends to incentivize higher quality milk and better agriculture practices. And because healthy cows put to pasture, eating green out there will produce more valuable milk than sick cows in stalls or in corrals. Some states have tried to create better policies for milk. California, for example, has higher standards for components of 1 and 2% milk than the government requires. Higher protein content, more calcium, and so forth. Yet the government's trying to stop and shut down California standards. The federal government is also fighting local organic and small dairy producers, mainly because of its cozy relationship with Big Dairy, the USDA's Dairy and Industry Advisory Lobby. And then there's the pseudo-independent dairy management, which owns the trade names American Dairy Association, National Dairy Council, and U.S. Dairy Export Council. So at the bottom of all this is that there's two ways of looking at it. No one has died by drinking organic certified raw milk. But, and that's in 38 years, but there have been 80 deaths from pasteurized factory farm milk in the same period of time, including 50 people were killed in 1985 alone by cheese from pasteurized milk. So if you want the healthiest milk, if you drink milk, then we should be letting our legislators know no more factory farm dairy. You want organic. And I believe if enough people protested, you could end up getting raw milk back. Right now, you can't. It's against the law. Years ago, I wrote a book on natural pet care. I did a PBS special on natural pet care that aired on PBS stations around the country. It was very popular. In no small reason, because so many pet owners are having sick pets. And I was thinking about this when I was flying out to Denver to premiere my first program on the large PBS station there. I had just returned a few weeks before from Italy and in France also. In both Italy and France, especially in the countryside, I was amazed at how healthy older cats and dogs were. In fact, on one particular farm, there were both cats and dogs. They were lean, they were healthy, they were bouncing around. And I said, how old are they? Expecting the guy to say, oh, 7, 8 years old. 25, 26, 27 years old. You would be hard put to find any dog in the United States alive in their mid-20s. And sometimes cats. I remember used to be very common where I grew up to have old cats living into their late 20s. Not today. Today, unfortunately, because of the high incidence of immunization, much of which is not necessary, and the processed foods, you're having cats and dogs that are as sick as the humans that care for them. This is from the Ledger. Quote, for many years when I started my career in veterinary medicine as a veterinarian technician, I remember being puzzled as to why we vaccinated cats in so many locations on their bodies. The rabies vaccine was given in one leg, while the feline leukemia vaccine was given in another leg, and other vaccines were given yet another leg. When I was brave enough to ask why we vaccinated cats this way, I was given my first taste of veterinary oncology. Turns out that one out of every 10,000 cats, vaccines will cause something called vaccine-associated sarcomas. The notion that a vaccine can cause a type of tumor is scary for cat owners. However, over the past 10 to 20 years, there have been a lot of effort by the veterinary community to decrease this risk. Special risk forces have been developed to determine the best location to vaccinate your cat, how often to vaccinate, and the safest vaccine. You may have noticed that your veterinarian used to vaccinate your cat between the shoulder blades, and now they do it on a leg or a tail. This practice was developed to make it easier to treat a tumor if it occurred. Some vaccines are administered every year, while others can be administered every 3 years to decrease the risk of developing a sarcoma. Vaccines such as feline leukemia virus may only be given to your cat if your veterinarian feels your pet is at risk from catching this virus. Now, here's my thoughts. I believe that most of the vaccines given to dogs and cats have never been proven to be effective, and none of them are safe. I also believe that similar to the food we prepare, the canned food, the bag food, these are very low grade. In fact, a grade that would not be acceptable for human use is then allowed to be used in your pet, as if somehow your pet is immune from food coloring agents, monosodium glutamate, artificial color and dyes. They're not. They're not immune at all. And that's why we have dogs and cats developing a myriad of diseases we never saw in the past at a very high percentages. So my suggestion is, if your cat or dog is sick, you can detoxify them using homeopathic zeolites and using blood purification mechanisms that also work on humans. Read, go to your library and just take out Natural Pet Care and just read it. If you have a dog, a cat, a bird, a horse, a ferret, because all those are covered. Next up, parsley. How many people put parsley on the side of the plate and keep it there when it's been put on your dish in a restaurant? Rarely do we eat parsley. Some people eat a form of parsley called cilantro, mainly in curry dishes. But outside of that, almost never do you have someone ask for parsley. Even in a health food store, parsley is not one of the primary juicing ingredients, but it should be. The British Medical Journal published a medical study to measure the antioxidant capabilities of parsley. A group of people ate a restricted diet for 2 weeks, which was high in parsley, but low in other foods containing flavones and other natural sources of antioxidants. Then the urinary excretion of the flavone, apigenin, was measured before and during the ingestion of parsley. Apigenin levels were noticeably higher when parsley was added to the diet. The researchers noted that when the subjects were on a restricted diet, their oxidative stress markers rose. However, when people added parsley during the second week of the study, the parsley was able to reverse these numbers somewhat. Now, the Journal of Ethnopharmacology, a major journal, published a study confirming the diuretic effects of parsley, as claimed for years in folk medicine literature. If you want to get rid of swelling from edema in the ankles or in the face, you took parsley. In fact, rats were given parsley seed tea to drink, and over a 24-hour period, the rats had a marked increase in urinary volume. You urinate a lot, and that also helps urinate out a lot of the toxins. And herbalists have been using parsley for the kidneys, joint problems, nerves, and more. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. John Christopher. I was very young at the time. It was one of the very first major lectures I had ever done. I was fortunate to have a monster best-selling book. It was one of the two biggest selling crossover health books in history. Dell Davis had the other. And I was invited out to Arizona. I was on this long tour. I got to Arizona. I went to my lecture. Turns out I was in the wrong part of the building. And when they finally found me and I went to the right part of the building, the lecture had been going on for about 15 to 20 minutes. But there was two people lecturing. One was Dr. Pablo Arola, and the other was Dr. Christopher, the same John Christopher. And he had this really beautiful, long hair. Kind of reminded me of an older lion. It had a very strong constitution. Pablo Arola, on the other hand, was shorter and had very black hair. And I listened to him for another 10 minutes, and then I went over and did my lecture. And afterwards, they said that they lived there in Phoenix, and did I want to, you know, go out and have something to eat? And I said, sure, because these two people were just legend, and it was wonderful to hear their stories. And Dr. Christopher in particular had hundreds and hundreds of herbs in his place, in jars and hanging and in bags, and he knew what every single one did, because that's what he was a master of. There was no better herbalist in America for 50 years than John Christopher. And I remember him telling me that people don't realize how easy an herb can help them. Well, parsley was one of the things that were made that night. He made us parsley juice. He had apple, which is most of the juice, and then parsley. And I'd never had an apple with parsley juice. And it was very tasty and very strong. And he said, that's good for your kidneys and good for your bladder. And if you ever end up with jaundice, that'll help as well. And he said he helped people with edema using this, and you'd use it parsley root tea if you had stiff fingers, if you couldn't move your joints well. Parsley would help it. Also, it helped with olive oil, and parsley helped with gallstones. And you'd have to drink a pint of fresh parsley tea every day. The herb is also calming to the nerves and adrenal glands. And Dr. Christopher recommended at least 2 quarts of strong parsley tea every day for those issues. And according to Dr. Christopher, fresh parsley juice, probably an ounce, much like wheatgrass juice, is a very potent healer. It can effectively be a blood tonic. It has to be diluted, and I would suggest apple juice as he did. And what I really liked was the conversation we had, because we stayed up virtually all night talking. I didn't know why they wanted to speak with me. I was just becoming known, but I had none of the experience that these people had. And finally, Dr. Christopher turned to me and he said, when I was about to leave, go to the airport, he said, I now see the future in the health movement in the United States. He said, for a long time, there's just been a handful of people, Carlton Fredericks and Gaylord Houser and Adele Davis. They've controlled the whole movement. And people such as us, meaning Dr. Arola himself and Bob Hoffman, they had pretty much been excluded because they were purists. They didn't drink, they didn't smoke, they didn't drink coffee. He was vegetarian. And he said, you look at these people. Carlton Fredericks drinks and smokes right on stage for television and promotes a high-protein diet. And he said, these people, they just don't have the ethics or character. And he said, we won't last a whole lot longer in the field because the field is changing. He said, I was amazed at how many young people were there tonight. He said, Dr. Arola said, he said, normally when there's a health lecture anywhere in America, all you see are the white-headed people, like an intellectual Broadway play. He said, it's just the older people holding on to the information given to them by the people they've been around. He said, but there's no one young in the field. He said, it's all yours, no one else. Boy, that made me feel sad. All the way back in the plane, I kept thinking that about this transition, that there was no one young in the field. In every field, you have young people willing to work with the older generation so that there's a transition. And not that you stop if you're older. It's just that where are the younger people going to go? And I found that that was true. That was the only time I ever saw Dr. Christopher. Now, what I was told that he lived to be 104. I don't know if that's true or not. But all I know is when he went to shake my hand, he had a grip that was one of the strongest I've ever had felt in my life. And I'm going to guess at that point he was in his 80s. And Arola, they were both just real gentlemen. But wise beyond measure. And it was Pavel Arola who suggested that if you're going to have people who are going to have blood pressure, what I do, he said, is I give them black tea. I said, why is that? He said, because black tea helps people reduce their risk of heart disease and lowers their blood pressure. And that stuck in my mind because no one I knew drank black tea. Well, here's the latest study from the Journal of the American Medical Association's Archives of Internal Medicine. Quote, black tea may offer blood pressure promise and reduce the risk of heart disease in the general population. How about that? These are a group of scientists from Unilever University in Australia. Our study, quote, has demonstrated for the first time to our knowledge that long-term regular consumption of black tea can result in significant lowering of blood pressure in individuals with normal to high normal range blood pressure. Okay, this is terrific because A, it's inexpensive. B, you can always alter the taste. Black tea tends to be a little tart, but you can put Melaleuca honey in it. You can put some lemongrass in it, lemongrass and Melaleuca honey in with the black tea, and it tastes delicious. So that is good news, but I heard that information at the very beginning of my career from the gentleman who was one of the best natural hygienists in American history, Pavel Arola. For those of you who would like to do Tai Chi, good news for you. If you have Parkinson, it helps you. That's the latest. Tai Chi, a simple exercise. I'm sure you've seen people doing it, very slow motion. It's actually a martial art. It's slow, flowing movement and meditation. It helps improve balance and movement control for people with Parkinson's disease. Now, this is in the New England Journal of Medicine. Quote, in the latest study to show the benefits of Tai Chi for people with chronic health problems, past studies have shown that Tai Chi reduces falls and depression among the elderly and lessens pain for patients with arthritis and fibromyalgia. In Parkinson's disease, nerve cells in the brain that produce the chemical dopamine begin to die. Lower dopamine production can lead to tremors, balance problems, stiff facial expressions, and muffled speech, among other problems. And then it goes on to talk about how Tai Chi in a group of people with Parkinson improved their condition substantially. Well, that's good news. So that's all good. Black tea, terrific for you. Tai Chi, helping as well. And parsley, great if you have edema. Most overweight people have edema. Most people have high sodium in the face. Diet have facial edema. You ever notice the bags, puffiness under the eyes and the cheeks? That's a form of edema. So parsley cleanses the blood. So that's just the latest in our area of health and nutrition. And we should be advocating for organic. Even though I don't drink dairy, I believe people should have the right to drink raw milk organically grown. Grasses where cattle can graze on those. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. And video streaming live from our studio in New York City. In the last week, some of you have had trouble downloading shows, going to our archives, even getting on to listen, for a simple reason. About 7 days ago, we launched our new website, progressiveradionetwork.com, and I knew at the time that there would take a little bit of time to work out all the problems with it. It's inevitable. What I didn't know, would there be 44,000 people all coming on at the same time and just leveled our bandwidth. So that caused a whole week of delay in getting a new dedicated server. That's why that happened. And as a result, we weren't able to get your programs uploaded so you could download them. All that changes tomorrow when we have a brand new full bandwidth where we can hold 200,000 people downloading a show simultaneously. And if you think that's a lot, I had 200,000 downloads last week. So we're growing by leaps and bounds. About 5,000 brand new listeners every day of the week. So I thank all of you for coming on board. And most importantly, telling your friends and other people the quality information that we're sharing with you. Joining me in studio right now is Luann Panessi. She has a background. She, after being an oncological nurse, which is a cancer nurse in intensive care, and then being a nurse administrator, overseeing 100 nurses at Long Island Jewish Hospital, and then going on to do 4 years of graduate work in Chinese medicine, and then going into nutrition, and becoming a holistic nurse herself after a great deal of hesitation and looking at what worked and what didn't. She now is one of America's foremost holistic nurses. And she also does a lot of the review of the people who've gone through health protocols to see how they're doing. So we have a good database that we can share with people. Well, Elizabeth is not here today, but Luann was back and looking at our new studio, and which goes up tomorrow. And so she jumped in here and took some of the questions from people in the audience. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary. Wonderful show so far. And I wanted to kind of share this with you. When I work with people and we're doing holistic type modalities, alternative medicine, and they're learning about all this stuff like IV ozone and high dose vitamin C and things like that, people often say to me, "Well, if it's so effective, how come we're not using it in general medicine? How come it's not being recognized?" And then I then go into an explanation about the motives and the myth behind all of the beliefs that conventional medicine holds in order to operate so that they can keep making a profit and keeping their business going. Well, I was watching 60 Minutes tonight, and I've already had about a dozen emails about this come in. there was a gentleman on 60 Minutes who was an engineer from MIT, and he came up with the most amazing innovation about education, and it was about 10-minute interval internet teaching, which is, it's brilliant, and yet, I think Leslie Stahl was the interviewer, and she asked him, well, if it's so effective, you know, why is this coming from an engineer and not coming from the halls of conventional education? Why didn't it come from them? And it reminded me of what you were talking about last week, about this whole concept of the official truth and myth. And I'm sure that all of these people who emailed me would love to get your perspective on this.
What did the gentleman say? Why did this innovation come from an engineer from MIT and not from anyone in academia?
Well, basically because academia will protect their official truths. They can't go beyond that because that's what perpetuates
okay.
them.
I'll share a larger concept. Let's start with, let's reverse the issue and start with, why do we have so many problems today? When we're clearly smarter than most of the predicaments we get ourselves into. Just imagine a parent talking with a teenage, let's say a 17, 18-year-old son or daughter saying, why did you end up getting yourself into trouble? Why did you do this or that? And then the person, you're smarter than that. And the people say, yeah, they are smarter, but that doesn't mean that they have character. Here is how I see all of this. And I gave this same insight at Indian Point, and I'm going to thank all the people from this audience who showed up there. It was an enormously positive, powerful, we can do something group. But I said, there'll be Harvey Wasserman and others who can tell you all the reasons why nuclear is not green, it's not clean, it's not inexpensive, and it's not safe. And yet, that's what we believe. That's what the average person believes. That's what our politicians believe. That's what the media believes. Well, how is it that this group knows better, and they came from all walks of life, all races, categories, rich, poor, employed, unemployed, PhDs, and never been to college? It was a full spectrum. But they all had a truth that it evaded everyone else in America. But I said, I'm not going to talk about nuclear. But I want to ask this. How many of you here are vegans? All these hands went up. And how many of you here know other ways of dealing with your problems in life than just getting angry at someone? All these hands went up. How many of you are looking for ways of getting off the grid so you produce less of a footprint? You use less of the resources? Hands went up. How many of you are opposed for scientific reasons the use of mandatory vaccines? All the hands went up. And I said, do you think it would make sense to be here because you allowed yourself not to be propagandized, but rather to be educated about nuclear and still be propagandized about eating a McDonald's, drinking a Coca-Cola, watching some reality TV show, shopping at a Walmart, even if you have been downsized from a job that now you're buying a product that isn't sold from China to Walmart? And I said, no, it wouldn't make sense. It makes sense that you're all here, and it makes sense that you're vegan and you want to support organic and locally grown farm goods, and you want to either homeschool your child or you want a quality public education, and you won't vote. I said, how many of you are going to vote for either the Democrat or Republican? None of the hands went up. How many of you will vote for an independent person? All the hands went up. Now, there are any number of independent people to choose from. Even if they don't win, rather than not voting, you're voting in a protest vote for someone who has a higher level of principles and platforms. So here's the issue. Pull back again. The media do not intend to mislead us. It's not their intent. No pharmaceutical company intends to hurt or kill us. It's not their intent. No doctor I know of in the United States wakes up today thinking, how can I really hurt a patient? They don't. They really believe that do no harm is the first principle of the Hippocratic Oath. No nurse intends to cover up the crimes that they see of incompetence, malfeasance, and just stupidity in operating rooms where a patient gets an infection or gets a sponge left in their body, or they operate in the wrong way, and so there's now come this bad for the patient, including death. They don't mean to get up that day and cover all that up. No cop wakes up today and says, if my buddy shoots an innocent kid in the back of the head, I'll go plant a gun to make it look like the kid was shot at us and was running away. No cop does that. Doesn't wake up to do it. Politicians don't get up and say, I want to be corrupt. I want to be pimping for everyone who's got money. I want to be the ultimate pimp. I want to outdo any pimp you've ever seen on any street corner in a pimp mobile and with a high platform shoes and enough bling to cause arthritis in any part of your body you're wearing it on. I'm not waking up today to be everyone's pimp. No dietitian wakes up in the morning saying, I want to make sure all my patients are malnourished by the time I get finished with them by giving them what they're going to eat in hospitals. No teacher gets up saying, how can I make my students dumber? How can I make myself more illiterate? No one gets up saying, isn't it great that everyone I know in government is inefficient? If the public were only smart enough to come here and see that 80% of what we do is not needed, and 80% of the people here doing what is not needed are redundant and shouldn't be here. But our union protects us, and so no one's going to do anything. But they don't get up with that idea. Nobody gets up to do bad like this, to be incompetent, stupid, vile, greedy, selfish, self-absorbed. We don't start the day that way, but most people end the day that way. So get out of the idea that there's 1%, 99%. No, we're all complicit at different levels. So then how come we don't change? For a simple reason, because the brain cannot, unless you're an exceptional person, cannot handle multiple truths simultaneously with equal validity. Hence, you can't be happy and sad, honest and a liar, a thief and have high integrity. You can't be a person's best friend, never to say anything bad, and then stab them in the back. You can't be both simultaneously. You can be one or the other. And yet, that all comes from our conditioned self. But the conditioned self is in everyone. But every institution has a conditioned self also. If you're given a position of power within any institution, the church, the educational system, the military, the energy cartels, for any form of energy, the health industry, medicine, nursing, social work, you must abide by the rules that have been given to you. If not, you are excommunicated. But not immediately. First you're warned, then you're threatened, then you're punished. You just don't go to punishment because they still feel that the inducements they're giving you, the rewards they're giving you, will outweigh any need for you to seek any verification of the rightness of your choices outside of the official version. So that means that all institutions in the United States, including your Marxist, Leninist, socialist, communist, anarchist, your non-commercial, radicalized, racially biased radio stations, all of this is official. You can survive and thrive in any of those institutions, providing you do not seek any challenge against any of the policies or principles that would undermine the control of who's running it and the power of the institution by letting the world know this institution is not needed, it's archaic, it's just a bunch of stupid rituals. All you have to do is look for the truth, and it will shock you at how stupid you've been by allowing these idiots to control your life. Now, that's someone inside saying that, right? They're not going to allow that to happen. So let's just say now today that you, Luann Panessi, have found a cure for cancer, all right? And you have treated 100 patients, and each mother's 100 have reversed their cancer, terminal cancer. That means that orthodox medicine has given up on them, sent them home under hospice care with morphine and some medication, knowing it'll be a day to maybe 6 months, but they're going to die. But you come along and you take those patients, and with your unique insights that do not ever come from established institutions, they come from being outside of the institution. Hence, by their very nature, they're unofficial. And by being unofficial, they cannot be accepted by anyone inside the institution. So now your patient goes back to the doc, says, "Doc, a miracle, miracle. You know, 6 months ago you told me I had a month to live, but today I'm alive and well, I'm cancer-free." Doc says, "Yeah. What happened?" "Well, I started getting ozone and vitamin C drips and colon cleansing and liver flushes and homeopathic and herbs and juices, and my cancer started to dry up and off, and it was just amazing." What doctor? It wasn't a doctor. It was a nurse that did this. First, the doctor would say, "That's all nonsense, and I'm not happy with what you've done." And you stop for a moment and say, "Well, hold on, doctor, I'm alive." "Well, that's not the point. I told you you had to die, so damn you, die." "But doctor, I'm alive." "Where? I don't give a if you're alive or not. You disobeyed me. Now, how do you think that's going to make me look when the next cancer patient comes to me and says, 'Is there any chance?' And I say, 'I'm sorry, no, here's your morphine, go home.' You're going to undermine the confidence the patient has in me if this gets out. Now, who's this nut job? Who's this quack?" And then a call goes over to the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society, the official institutions. "What do you know about this?" "Oh, it's just all nonsense." "Okay, have you studied?" "No, but we're sure it's nonsense." "Have you interviewed any of the patients, the doctors?" "No, but we're sure it's nonsense." So with no proof whatsoever, with no examination, you're sure it's nonsense. Of course it's nonsense, because there can only be one truth. That is the official truth. And we are the only official institutions. So if you went to 100 institutions, if you went to MD Anderson in Houston, Texas, if you went to Roswell Park, if you went to Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, Sloan Kettering, if we're not curing it, it can't be cured, because we're the only ones who are officially designated to do it. So therefore, it's just quackery. How do we deal with this? Call the New York Times. New York Times, the biggest ass-kissing newspaper in the history of the world. And they really are fools there, but they're so pretentious, thinking they actually are smart. But they are great at guarding the gates of orthodoxy. You will never find them finding a conspiracy. It's not possible. And they're never going to look where the truth is. They'll look where the official truth is. So if you go over there and you say, "No, so what are you telling us?" Well, then the first call that person that the New York Times is going to do is they're going to call someone at the National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society, or some oncologist. "We have a patient who said that, well, it couldn't happen." "Okay, so it was quackery." "It's absolute quackery. Trust us." "Okay, well, you're official. They're not, so I have to trust you. Because if I'd stop trusting you, I wouldn't have access to anything more official stories, and I wouldn't have advertising from your official institutions." All right, so you go to 60 Minutes. They do the same thing. They're all doing the same game. That's just in medicine. But what about the patients? They're irrelevant. A patient is only relevant. A voter is only relevant. A citizen is only relevant when they're accepting the official paradigm unquestioningly. So the idea is to reach a point where the public is so incapable of making independent choices for themselves that whatever you tell them to do, mandatory vaccines, right, 10 for your kid, no, 20, no, hey, how, let me go in the other room. Fellas, how many vaccines are in the pipeline? About 80. Okay, 80 vaccines for your kid. Do we need it? Would I tell you to take him if we didn't need him? Now, call Alec. Alec, meet with all the state legislatures, you know, the pimps, those little agendas are, who actually pretend they care about anything except themselves. Tell them these are the 861 separate laws that they're going to pass, and these are the laws that are going to change to make sure that every kid in New Jersey has to take Gardasil. But we heard that there's no science behind it. Doesn't matter if there's no science.
And make sure that you're not allowed to sue them.
You can't sue them. So they must take it. And if they challenge it, then we have to put fear into them, and the media will do that for us, because the media does whatever we say. these are irresponsible parents, and then bring in child services to take the child away and arrest the parent and make sure it's on the news so other parents get the idea. And then let's give them identity cards, and let's give them identity chips, and let's get in there and make sure that no one's going to protest, because we hear in other areas, our war in Afghanistan, our war everywhere, our war being the suck-ups, this little bunch of punks running Netanyahu's Likud government, and wants to bomb Iran for no other reason to be the superpower in that area with the only nuclear weapon. But we got to make sure anyone who protests this war is now put on the FBI watch list. And since the FBI has never had an original thought in its history, and will only do what it's told without ever thinking that maybe they're doing it wrong, they have no conscience. That comes out of your brain when you go to the FBI or CIA or Homeland Security. And let's get these people, couldn't work anywhere else in the world, so let's give them a federal status and militarize them to be a TSA agent. Now, the good news is for your TSA agent, it's the only time in your life you'll be able to grope people, grab their breasts, their crotches, and smile doing it and not get arrested. Isn't it great? It's wonderful. The only other thing you haven't done yet is proctal examinations. You know, be able to look up someone's ass and enjoy yourself doing it and be able to do it legally. Isn't it amazing what if you did it outside that door, you'd be arrested as a sexual
Gary,
offender?
Gary, don't give them any ideas.
No, they'll get around to it. You can trust me they can get around to you. So in other words, every single person in every single institution has been living with the idea that as long as they do what the institution tells them, their single truth, the official truth, they're never held accountable, ever, for anything. But the moment you challenge any official truth and say, your official truth, is it a universal truth? What do you mean? Well, we gave you the Nobel Prize for Peace, and yet you're the biggest warmongering president in American history. And you support torture, and you support assassination and rendition. You support all these things. Is there something wrong with this Nobel Prize? No, because this is Orwellian. The person who is most likely to support those who commit war in the name of keeping us free is able to control everything about the military-industrial complex, which means we'll never cut that budget. And as long as we're talking about taking away people's rights, we want to make sure the American public never wakes up and says, what the hell have I been doing with my life? My kid has diabetes, adult diabetes, and won't live as long as the adult. The people who trusted that their society would be a clean, healthy, safe place now realize that they've ghettoized America by so subordinating unions and bringing in 8.2 million workers from India, mainly, who have higher degrees and are good at engineering, to replace highly educated, very skilled Americans who thought they were safe because they're not just out of college. They've been around for a while, but the trouble is we're paying them too much, and that's a bad thing. It's a good thing to pay them minimum wage and give them few benefits because that profit can go to the people who had the corporations and to their stockholders. So now how many people ever question how their stockholding money and dividends are made? None of them. But isn't this the 99%? Yes. And how many of the 99% shop in Walmart and other box stores where the items made once made in America, now made there? 51,000 factories have closed since the last 12 years. Do any Americans care about that? Evidently not, including ones who've lost their jobs, because they're also using their credit cards, the very people who put them into deep debt with compounding interest, and then they're feeding them genetically engineered food and taking away their rights to eat organic food and taking away their rights to supplements and harassing alternative health care practitioners and making it difficult anyone who's actually challenging the prevailing view. So any group of people must be denied any credit for anything. Now, the irony of it is every single quote I give on my show for a study that shows something heals is all from Orthodox medicine. So here's the irony. Official institutions actually have a great deal of truth within them, but that truth cannot be used by anyone outside to change what's in them. So the fact that you have someone who is reporting on parsley doing good doesn't mean tomorrow every doctor in America will start using parsley, every nutritionist use parsley. If we tell you the coenzyme Q10 is good for your heart and your mitochondria, it doesn't mean tomorrow that everyone who has defective mitochondria will be using coenzyme Q10. If you use any of that information to benefit yourself, a different truth, a universal truth, but you don't benefit the institution, then the institution threatens you and excludes you. Then you become the far left, the far right. You become the libertarians. You become the constitutionalists. You become the Peace Party, the Justice Party, the Green Party, or even the Tea Party, who were principally against the war and the way our money is spent when we are taxed, all of which is legitimate. But then they marginalize all these movements. The official left marginalizes them, and the official right marginalizes them. So all that allows you is a difference of personalities, where Keith Urban is the Rush Limbaugh of the left. All right, and so you have these people volleying their ideologies with their absolutely indoctrinated audience watching this as if they were watching gladiators fight, not realizing the game is rigged, it's fixed. Because the people that own Fox and own MSNBC and own CNN are the real power, and you don't see them. The people that control the election outcome. Only a fool would watch any of the election results or campaigning at all, because none of the real issues are they dealing with. Not at all. Have you heard any of the candidates talk about feeding 12 million hungry American children?
None.
Stopping immediately home foreclosures.
Mm-mm.
Helping those 43 million Americans who have lost their homes to regain homes? No. Forgiving student loan debt? Bringing down interest rates to 2%? No. Helping small businesses with interest-free loans? No. The things that can make a difference, you haven't heard a word about, and you're not going to, because, remember, there's only one truth if you're Republican and Democrat. If you're rich, middle class, or poor, or working poor, stay within your paradigm, and you will be given the absolute confidence that the future is good. It's going to be bad for everyone. But only when you're out of that, become independent, can you then see the truth for what it is. Hope that answers that issue.
It sure does.
Now, I had a fellow stop me on the street just coming down to do my show, and he said, Gary, he said, I'm 22 years old, I graduated from Harvard, and I heard that you're doing a new book for young people. I said, yes, it's at my publisher now. He said, do you address the whole concept of love? Because my generation is absolutely clueless about love. Unless it's self-love, and that's narcissism, I suggest. So what I've done, I've just taken a little bit, only a small part of the chapter in my new book, coming out, I don't know, 3 months, 5 months, for people in their 20s, teens, 30s. This is on the subject of love. I'll quote a few minutes of this. Love is usually not understood. We're almost illiterate in the language of love because our ego-based dominant culture doesn't allow us to see love for what it is. This lack of fluency stems from a failure to distinguish between the I, the it connection, where the other is it, an object, and the I, therefore, the other person is a mensch, a lover. If we don't comprehend that a person cannot be treated like an object, to be manipulated, then we will never reach a level which we can fully live the I-thou sacred relationship. Our society has continued to be illiterate on these two dimensions of language and living and of relating or not relating. If you're living in the ego-based, I'm here, love me, hug me, kiss me, reward me, I'm special, but don't ask me to show up on time, don't ask me to care about anyone else but myself, don't ask me to carry on a literate conversation, don't ask me to think out of the box, because I've lived in the box, but it's been a very nice velvet-lined box. The mental life, the love in the deeper sense, is simply not available to them. We can begin by looking at emotional displacements and intellectual short-sightedness that connect to an inability to express love. From the earliest ages, we are taught that compromising is the only way to be realistic in this world, and that you have to abandon what you really believe in to fit in. The problem is that the more that we compromise and abandon the highest things we believe in, love, kindness, generosity, compassion, caring for others, the more we sacrifice those in order to achieve whatever is achievable within the way that our workplace is structured, the way our family life is structured, and then the more we find ourselves being miserable and unhappy. The desire to follow the straight and narrow within the limiting confines of mainstream society means that we block and override, often subconsciously, many humanitarian impulses that seem out of place. One way to discourage the flowering of love in your life is to stop a positive impulse in its tracks by multiplying evasions and rationalizations instead of moving to act compassionately. When someone asks you to help out, a load of side worries and doubts block any activity in your, on your part. Oh, I wish I could, I can't afford it, and so it goes. We don't teach our students how to be decent human beings. We teach them how to pass tests. All they're trained is how to be manipulative, how to be clever, how to trick and outwit people, and also how to operate under high stress with deferred gratification. They're supposed to get ahead so that naturally they just want to go straight out, go to Wall Street or some corporation, and rush off to some big firm and then make more money. Today they think status is connected with money, and therefore money is the key to everything, including happiness, and from happiness you're going to find the right love. Yet all the research and even everyday evidence shows that beyond a certain point of material goods, the happiness issue goes down. People become more stressed and more worried the more money they have. Money is modern men and women's god, because in a certain way it is a god. Money also has this quality of all-pervasiveness, as God does. By increasingly becoming the absolute sufficient expression and equivalent of all values, in the sense that in the market everything has a price, which is money. To put this another way, if a wealthy man, say, loves to drink good wine, he can spend a lot of money on it, but in the end, he can only drink so much. If he is at all rational, his purchases will be limited. But since money can buy anything and everything, another man may just keep amassing more and more money, since his possession is not limited to any particular act of compassion or use. We can see that the second man is out of touch with his own desires and inner self. The wine drinker at least is chasing something that gives him sensual pleasure. The money chaser is after something which, unless it is spent and so no longer is no longer money, offers no real sensual satisfaction. The skewed values I have been talking about commonly arise from early negative programming. During our child development period, we learn from our parents and our family and our community the characteristics of what life is all about. We download their beliefs and their behaviors into our life and then try to run out our life based on those experiences. Usually from these sources, the child is given a fragmentary, unclear idea of love and compassion. A child can only pick up the pieces that are learned through this developmental programming. These fragmented ideas will be further distorted if the parent's relationship is off-center. If I grew up in a family where there was an abusive parent, and every day I started receiving this abuse, I begin to acquire a program expecting this kind of activity every day. Once a person is out of the parent's orbit, he or she may still be looking forward to feeding this habit of abuse as long as the individual has not questioned old programs. Another dysfunctional family situation is found when the child wasn't accepted early in life as a lovable person. If you're not looked upon as a lovable being, then frequently you'll go through much of your life trying to compensate. And let's add one final note. Even when an individual has grown up and can escape family influences, he or she is still facing input from the mass media, which is not likely to present a positive humanistic concept of love. If you doubt me, look at all the reality shows. They do not ever focus upon love, but lust. They never focus upon compassion and giving, but rather manipulation and dominance. A large percentage of the population is trying to awaken to this point, awaken to a better understanding of life. We find the media is holding us back. And the reason why is because when we become awakened, we will become empowered. And the powers to be recognized that are not going to awaken, therefore, any longer to control us. If political leaders and social leaders set the power of love as a priority, then when they go into office, those summits with the intention of resolving the differences would not get caught up in the tit-for-tat linear mind interactions that will only create war. Unfortunately, as we know, the highest reaches of wealth and power, tit-for-tat is the name of the game. So what is authentic love? Love is the ability to have kindness and empathy and openness and vulnerability and a sense of connection with others in your life. Deep love is not a feeling or a psychic state of mind. It is the flow of the energy of the universe itself. Infinite union and communion and unity and flow and harmony. And that harmony is love where everything in it is of a nonviolent flow. When you break out of an ego-separated, cut-off-from-life way of looking at yourself, you step outside into love and touch reality and interconnectivity. The experience of pure connectivity may suddenly break out when, for instance, you see the beauty of a sunset, or the beauty in that person's eyes, your beloved eyes, or the beauty of your child. That love is the interconnected flow of reality. And when you touch interconnectivity, you're touching the fabric, the energy of reality itself. If interconnected love is a sustainable flow, then it certainly is not something you can hand out in neat parcels. As long as we are on the thrall in the dark side, we like to think that love is a commodity. You can barter. I love you. I don't love you. I was in love with you. I'm out of love with you. But I fell out of love for some reason. This is all nonsense. This dark-sided emotion is love with conditions. If I get this, you get that. You're an object. You've objectified one another, and love disintegrates. You can't have real love that way. So first off, interconnected love is all-embracing, something Jesus emphasized when Jesus spoke of love. When he spoke from love, he saw interconnectivity even with your enemy. Love your enemy is what he said. Whether he was a real historic or allegorical figure is immaterial. It is the statement that's important. So first off, interconnective love is what we should focus on. And if unconditional love is the compassionate movement into the midst of things, then it is the opposite of fear. Fear is the experience of being repulsed by a stimulus, and love is being attracted by a stimulus. Love pulls your attention and attracts you to create harmony in your life, which is absolutely the opposite of fear, which is something that repels you and encourages a splintering, which blocks and numbs you to fresh experience. If this love is embracing, it means going against the current tide in our society, which, according to mainstream media, is surrounded by enemies and dangers. These are some of the essential features of full-body compassionate love, the central component of a good life. And finally, trying to develop an intimate relationship without jettisoning baggage that interferes with self and other realizations, hoping that the relationship will end up helping them get rid of the baggage, will never happen. You have to drop the baggage, purge the baggage, and the bad programming before you enter any relationship. How many times have you said love, but in their very way of using the word, they were hypocritical or negative or judgmental or made you feel in some way obligated? But I give you love. The person starts to say, suddenly you know what's coming. They're going to say something negative to you as if by making you feel bad about yourself, they can control the energy that they're exchanging. Anyone who does that is not sharing love. And finally, when someone says something negative and does something negative all in the same time and in the name of love, it is not love they're manifesting. It is the dark side, a conditioned need for control or power. Instead of showing love, the person is making judgments against you in hopes of getting you to surrender to him or her. The person with this distorted view has succumbed so bad to programming, the kind that I've mentioned earlier, and is not working to forestall the damaging effects. Those are just some of the few ideas I have just in that one chapter. Hope that Jeremy, I hope that answers the question that you asked me on the street today. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen in.